session number 10759, Rule 1.
Mr. Anderson, Reel 1. When and how did you join the RAF, please?
I transferred from the Army in 1941, early 41. I was in an anti-aircraft unit before that.
What was the attraction?
The attraction was flying, which is what I always wanted to do. And I had the opportunity of transferring at that time in either the category of pilot or air observer.
It was easy for you to get in?
No, it wasn't easy. There was a little bit of bother trying to get out of the Army, and the selection procedure, even for wartime, was quite tough. The educational qualifications and the medical qualifications hadn't been relaxed at all.
Can you tell me about the training that you had and how well or how badly it fitted you for what you were to do later?
Oh, I think the training was first rate. Having just transferred to the RAF, I spent about a month in the aircrew reception centre. Then I was moved down to number 8 initial training wing at Newquay in Cornwall, where I did, I think it was an 8-week course, and basic training. This is elementary navigation and meteorology and stuff like that. Then we were sent over to Canada, and from Canada we were posted down to the States. And I was on a pilot's course there for a time. I actually did about 5 months on a pilot's course. And then they discovered I had an eye defect, slight eye defect, which could have affected my approaches on landing. So I was reassigned to an air observer's course in Canada. And I qualified as an air observer about 6 or 7 months later.
Can we say at this stage what an air observer was?
Yes, it was before the days of the category of navigator. An air observer actually did the lot. He was trained as a navigator, a bomb aimer, and air gunner. He also did a little bit of radio transmission work. Learned to use the RT set and whatnot. So he was a bit of an all-round character, really.
So the training before you actually got on to a combat squadron was something like 2 years?
Yes, probably slightly less than that. I was having been trained as an air observer, I was then sent back to this country, sent on an advanced navigation course in Scotland. That took about 2 months. From there I was posted to an operational training unit in Finningley, Yorkshire. That's when I crewed up and got together with my pilot and wireless op and gunners. There were 5 of us originally, and we did our training on Wellington 10s. We had a bad crash while we were in training. We crashed in the Isle of Man, and that really started my problems, medical problems, which manifested itself later on, actually. I landed up against the windscreen and my face was pushed in. But I was patched up, actually, at Ely, it's the RAF Hospital at Ely, and rejoined my crew, so I finished my operational training with them. From there we went to Blighton, RAF Blighton, and we converted to Halifaxes, did our 4-engine conversion, and did quite a bit of time on Halifaxes. Then we went to Lindholm, and we were converted to Lancasters, so we did about another 2 weeks at Lindholm to get to the feel of the Lancaster. And from Lindholm, we were posted to 166 Squadron.
Of these various bomber planes that you were flying, how did they compare with each other to actually be inside and to operate?
Well, the Wellington, of course, was a twin-engine bomber, and it was a good aircraft, rather cramped, but for what it was, I thought its performance was very good. It had Hercules engines, and it was capable of doing, you know, quite a good job on operations, I would have thought. The Halifax was a much more comfortable aircraft to fly in from the crew's point of view, but didn't have the performance. The Lancaster, of course, was, I think, from an operational point of view, was superb. It was an aircraft that I suppose had been designed by mistake. As you probably know, it originally originated as the Manchester and was then converted by Avro's to their own design to the Lancaster. So in actual fact, it was designed as a bomber, and I suppose they thought of the crew afterwards, because the accommodation from the crew was decidedly cramped. But it was an excellent aircraft for operations, and it carried a fantastic bomb load. Eventually, the Pathfinder squadrons were carrying up to 22,000 pounders on them. Our average bomb load on main force bomber command, that was my 166 squadron experience, was somewhere around about 8,000 pounds. We would normally go in with a 4,000 pounder and probably four 1,000 pounders. But when I got to the Pathfinder squadron, we were carrying, because our main job there was to mark the target, so we carried six target indicators usually, and then made up the rest of the bomb load with 1,000 pounders.
You took nearly 2 years of training before you actually got onto operations.
Well, as I said, I was injured in this crash at OTU, and that put me into hospital for a time. And then, as a result of my injuries, I had one or two complications. So while I was at Blighton, I had to go back into hospital for a couple of weeks. So this, I suppose, lengthened it, you know.
Were you impatient to get on operations or apprehensive?
Oh, yes. No, I don't think we were apprehensive. I think we were, the enthusiasm was terrific. I think all crews, all crew members were dead keen. They firmly believed in what they were doing. And I think we were all very keen to get on a squadron. Of course, I don't think we had any idea at that time of the loss rate, what the percentage loss rate was. And our experiences, obviously, were determined by our immediate surroundings. I mean, if we knew of any loss rates, it would be restricted to the squadron we served on, for instance.
Once you were doing the training, were there any people whom you met, any higher officers who particularly stood out in the training?
Well, I didn't come into contact with very sort of high senior ranks while I was training, but I was quite impressed with the American training, for instance. I thought that was extremely efficient. It was done on the old cadet system, which the RAF used before the war, and although in the RAF a flying cadet was probably the lowest form of animal life, in the American Air Force he ranked next to an officer and was given quite a lot of status, and he was referred to as Mr. It was a very good system. It one that had been perfected over a number of years, and I personally think the products they turned out on that were very good indeed. I was very impressed too with the system of training with the Canadian Air Force for air observers. I thought that was extremely efficient. A lot of the instructors that I met on the air observer course were schoolmasters. A lot of these had been secondary school teachers that had been drafted in to take things like navigation, meteorology and what have you, you know. Once you got onto operational training, like an OTU or a conversion unit, most of the instructors there were aircrew that had completed the tour of operations and were resting in between tours. And there, I think the standard of instruction was probably a bit limited, you know. I mean, after all, these people hadn't been trained as instructors, and the best that they could do, of course, was to hand on their experience to you. And sometimes, I mean, this was quite good, it was quite adequate. But sometimes I think it left gaps.
Can you tell me about 166 Squadron, its makeup?
Yes, 166 Squadron, by the time I joined it, had completely converted to Lancasters. Originally it was a Wellington squadron, and it was on an aerodrome at Kirmington in Lincolnshire, just south of the Humber. It was south of Hull, actually. And in fact, the aerodrome is now the South Humberside Airport. In those days, it was very much an emergency aerodrome with Nissen huts, a couple of runways, and that was about all. It was a three-flight squadron, so they could, at their peak, put 45 Lancasters into the air, and very often did, actually. They had had some... they'd had quite a battering before I joined the squadron, and the loss rate had been quite high. And in fact, although I was only on the squadron for about a month, in that month we did 10 operational sorties. I think we must have lost somewhere in the vicinity of about 16 or 17 aircraft, you know. So even then, the loss rate was quite considerable.
Did you know about the situation in the squadron when you first arrived there? Was it apparent to you?
No, the morale was very high. Very high indeed. And as again, one was struck immediately on joining the squadron by... the dedication that was exhibited, you know. There was a group of people who firmly believed in what they were doing and considered themselves actually an elite force.
Were there any particular personnel who served with it who stand out in your memory?
Oddly enough, one of the persons that did stand out in my memory wasn't an aircrew member at all. He was the intelligence officer, a chap called Bill Jones, who in fact has published a book quite recently called Bomber Intelligence. And the book is about the operational squadrons that he served on. A very intelligent man, had a firm grasp of what he was doing, and I think had a very good influence on the crews. Because after all, he was doing a critical job. He very often had to interview these crews after they'd come back from a particularly hairy operation. And I was very impressed by his personality and very, very impressed by the way that he handled sometimes quite badly shot crews, you know. He was quite a personality. He was the one that really stood out to my mind. The other one was the station commander, who... a very paternal figure. He was, he'd been in the RFC in the First World War. I should think he was a man of about 50 plus. And unfortunately, I can't remember his name, but he was quite a personality. And I remember we came back from a particularly bad raid over Rovini. We were after a flying bomb assembly plant, and we'd gone to this place called Ravigny-sur-Ornaine. It was on the French-German border. And it was a raid that went badly wrong. The Pathfinder flares didn't go down in the right place, and the Luftwaffe were there waiting for us, and we lost four aircraft, actually, out of about 40 aircraft that had operated. And I remember his approach to the squadron on the next briefing that we did, and I thought he handled it superbly, you know. It was a situation where the morale, of course, could have sunk, and I lost one or two friends, actually, in a crew on that raid. And it was people like this, I think, that stuck out in your memory. The RAF had managed to get into these key positions, you know.
How did he handle it?
Well, he said that the squadron had had these hard knocks before, that we had a vital job to do, and that 166 Squadron was a superb body of men. It was a superb squadron with high morale, and he was quite sure that it would go on and, complete its duty in the way that the RAF expected. And I think the way that he put this over to, after all, a very young, impressionable group of men, I thought was quite good.
Do you remember your first operation?
Yes, very well. It was on a place called Achères, and it was a marshalling yard on the outskirts of Paris. I remember it quite well because we had two combats. We had a combat with a Focke-Wulf 190 on the way in, and another combat with another Focke-Wulf 190 on the way out. The raid itself, I thought, was quite successful. The Pathfinder flares had gone down in the right place, and the concentration of bombing looked superb. And later, when I went in to have a look at the photograph that we took of the raid, it looked as though our bomb load had landed in the right place.
Can you describe the combats with the Focke-Wulf?
Yes, this one came in to attack. It was a rear attack. He came in at an angle, slightly below us. Unfortunately, the rear gunner picked him up and gave his instructions also to the mid-upper gunner, so we both had a go at him, and I think they drove him off, because we went on the bombing run and dropped our bombs. And we'd just come out of the target area and had turned to come back virtually on a reciprocal. And as we levelled off to take our course for our homeward run, we were picked up by another Focke-Wulf 190. And it was almost an identical attack. Again, he came in from the rear and slightly below. And again, the rear gunner had picked him up. I think he'd picked him up with the background of the fires of the target, so actually the aircraft stood out, you know. And so the gunners had quite a night that night.
Which did you fear the most, the flak or the enemy fighters?
Oh, fighters. Yeah. I think fighters probably knocked down more aircraft than flak. Well, they undoubtedly did. And, of course, the Lancaster had a blind spot, as you probably know. I mean, there was no defence underneath it. And the favourite form of attack of a night fighter was to come up from underneath, and if possible, to try and hit you on the main spar. That's the part between the wings, which is the most vulnerable. So, I actually firmly believe that a lot of crews were knocked out of the sky without actually seeing the fighter. In fact, I was talking to one of our bomber command the other night, one of our group, and he was telling me that it was a Focke-Wulf that got him, actually, in exactly the same way. And the first time he spotted the Focke-Wulf was actually after he'd bailed out and he was parachuting down. So it was undoubtedly fighters. I think probably one of the reasons for... It seemed to be apparent when I joined Pathfinders. One of the reasons that probably the loss rate on Pathfinders, I think, was probably slightly lower than main force was... One, they were flying experienced crews, and two, the navigational techniques, I think, were better than main force. And I know it probably sounds brutal, but Pathfinder aircraft, the heavies anyway, were inclined to use the main force as a shield and stay in the centre of it. Very often, the people that got knocked down were the ones that actually strayed out of the bomber stream altogether and were actually on their own, on the extremes of it, you know, which was a particularly vulnerable thing to do.
Because you didn't get the cover from the other aircraft?
Yeah.
So was there any technique for protecting the blind spot of the Lancaster?
No, there wasn't really. There was no way of getting around it. In the end, the Luftwaffe were using aircraft that were specifically designed just to do that. They were using JU-88s with vertical firing guns, firing straight up. And they'd actually come in under the Lank and home in on your radar and then just let fly, you know.
But if there was a massed formation of Lancasters...
No, Bomber Command didn't use formation flying. Every raid we went in on a loose trail, actually. Every aircraft on Bomber Command was an individual crew. And... although, quite obviously, when you got to the target area and you saw other heavies, you were still a complete unit flying on your own, even in daylight raids. When I did daylight, I did a daylight raid, for instance, on Gelsenkirchen and with Pathfinders. And even there, we went in as a sort of a loose gaggle, really, in amongst other aircraft.
But even in a loose gaggle, if you're at different heights...
Yes, you could very often say, and I actually saw that on one occasion. We were approaching Frankfurt, and this was a night raid, and I saw a German aircraft there shoot down a Lancaster ahead of us, and I'm quite sure the crew didn't actually see him. Although we opened fire with our front guns to try and warn him, it was too late. I think this undoubtedly happened. I mean, I heard of another crew, for instance, when I was on 1-6 Squadron. It happened before we joined them. But the rear gunner actually saw a German fighter going in to attack another Lancaster about 400 yards off to his right, and actually swung his guns round at a 90-degree angle to the aircraft and opened fire on the German aircraft and actually shot it down, you know. So this sort of thing happened.
You were only a relatively short time with 166.
Yes.
But were there any other operations that you were on with that squadron that you can recount the details of?
Oh, yes. The other one that stuck up in my mind was Caen. We did the daylight on Caen in support of the Second Army, Monty's lot. And you know that Montgomery had got stuck trying to take Caen, and he called in Bomber Command. It was a daylight raid. I think it was about July the 7th, if I remember. Yes, it was, July the 7th. And I think it was, yes, it was somewhere around about early evening time we got there. And it was quite an experience. One, the run-up to the French coast. You could see quite a lot of the British, the Allied shipping and tank landing craft and whatnot approaching the coast. The other thing that stuck out, when you got over the French coast, you could see the British artillery units firing with their 25-pounders. You could actually see the powder trails in front of the guns where the shells had been leaving the, you know, the explosive had been marked out on the ground. And you could actually see some of the shells exploding on the German lines. We lost a flight commander at Caen, squadron leader Weston. And in fact, we saw him go down. He was about, I should think, 500 to 600 yards ahead of us. And we were flying directly behind him. And the flight engineer was actually in the front turret. And by this time, I'd got up alongside the pilot to see what was going on, you know, to get the fun. And he reported this Lancaster going down. In fact, we saw him going down. And the flight engineer engaged the gun crew that actually brought the aircraft down. Whether he silenced it or not, I don't know, because he was using, of course, 303 Brownings, which had a limited range, and we were up at that stage, it must have been about 3,000 feet, I suppose. But at least the gun didn't fire at us and didn't seem to be firing at anybody else. So Caen was quite an experience, but it was something that stood out in your mind, you know.
One hears that in those days, in the Battle for Normandy, the Allies had a massive control of the air.
Yes. Yes, they did. Yes. I didn't see any fighter intervention at Caen at all. Plenty of light flak, particularly, which was very effective at 3,000 feet, you know, you could imagine. But I didn't see any fighters. We saw one or two at Falais later on. We did a daylight on Falais, the Falais Gap. And that was, I think, somewhere around about 2 or 3 weeks later. Yes, it was August the 7th. Again, we went in to assist the Second Army. And I thought that was quite an effective raid. It was a daylight. And I've got a note in my diary, in my logbook there, that fighters and flak were very active indeed. So we had quite a bit of opposition there. Although we actually ourselves weren't engaged, I understand that several of the crews had trouble, you know.
Were you aware at that time that a trap was being drawn round the Germans at
Yes,
Falaise?
Yes, we pretty well knew this at the briefing. We kept a large map in the briefing room with the Allied advance on it, marked on it. And, I mean, we knew pretty well the progress the Allies were making. And I mean, for instance, on the Carn Raid, we knew jolly well why we were raiding it. It's interesting to note that my brother was in that action with the Royal Engineers, and he saw us going into Carn, he saw us bombing the target, and he was with the advance party that actually advanced on Carn immediately after the raid, you know. And he was saying that, in fact, the engineers had to get the bulldozers out to clear some of the rubble, you know, to get the Allied troops in.
In talking to soldiers who...
Yes.
experience these raids in support of their efforts.
Yes.
One always discusses with them the danger of their own aircraft
hitting
them.
Yes.
What comments have you got on that?
Well, it certainly didn't happen at Carn, because, in my opinion, Carn was extremely well marked. Now, but there was there were difficulties, I think, in one of the Falaise raids, where, in fact, the army had insisted on doing its own marking by using pot fires. So, in actual fact, they were marking out the area by putting down, presumably fired by mortars, you see, to mark the area. The snag was that the Germans very, very, very soon cottoned onto this, and they started lobbing them back, which caused a bit of confusion, you know. And I think it was in one of the Falaise groups that the Canadians got bombed. So that could happen. And, of course, you know, if you... The army actually were using an arm of the RAF which wasn't actually trained to do a tactical job. I mean, Bomber Command wasn't a tactical arm, it was a strategic arm. As I said previously, we weren't trained to fly in formation, for instance. So the techniques we used on these raids were the same techniques that we would use against a strategic target, you see. This necessitated very precise marking, which in fact they got at Carn. I'm not sure that this actually... Well, I'm quite sure, actually, it didn't happen at Falaise. Who, in fact, bombed the Canadians was problematical, because the American Tactical Air Force were out at the same time, and I think it's still a matter of some conjecture as to where the bombs came from.
From the kind of height at which you were bombing in Normandy, what kind of picture did you get? What kind of view?
Oh, Carn, you could see you could see the town quite distinctly. You could see the streets were outlined. I could even see the town square where this light anti-aircraft gun opened up on Squadron Leader Weston's plane, for instance. So you could see it quite distinctly. Of course, very soon, I looked back after we turned out of the target, for instance, and we were flying back again on a home course. That part of the town, which I think, if I remember rightly, was the eastern part of the town, it was probably the northeast side of the town, was obliterated in smoke and debris, you know. Because by the time you've got a couple of hundred heavies bombing, the smoke and the debris quickly obliterates the target, so you can't see anything, you know.
Did you prefer day or night bombing?
Well, the daylights were more interesting. You could see what was going on. The night bombing was quite spectacular. I think from a navigator's point of view,